Well, hello again there, folks, and welcome back to Classic Movies number 38. I am joined once again with Endeavour, and we've got another nice, happy movie for you here. Let's just check in on the chat. Am I coming through okay? Am I coming through okay in the chat there? There's a couple of new faces in the chat there that I'm seeing. I've already got, we're going to do Baron von Munchausen one day. Well, that was fortuitous time. So can you give me a one in the chat if I'm coming through okay? Excellent. Okay, I think we're ready to go. Loud and clear. Hello, boys. As Roddy Murray. It's nice when you see the same characters all the time, isn't it? And here we go. How are you doing, Endeavour?
I'm doing great.
I think we're cheating a little bit doing 1984 because let's be honest, like it is a good film. I think it's. We were just talking before we went live. I think it's as adaptations go, it's very very close. I think it gets the feel of the novel. And here we're not dealing with a book that we haven't read. We've both read the book. I read the book 5 times. But I did see the movie when I was a little kid, and it was a bit above my kind of pay grade. I didn't really get it. I didn't really understand what it was saying, and of course, now we all do. I mean, I read, I'll tell you, just to get us underway, I read 1984 for the first time in about 2003 or about 2004, and I lived in Belgium. It used to be the days when I was young, free and single, and I roamed around and I was doing I had a lonely backpacking guide. I worked abroad in the Dutch petrochemical sector. I lived in a little sort of provincial town and life was good. Life was good. And I remember, and in those days, I used to be able to sit because the Belgian TV, I only had like two TV channels or something, and I had a PlayStation 1, and then eventually I got a PlayStation 2. But in those days, I would sit down and read a book and just do nothing else all day. Say on a Sunday, if I'd been out on a Saturday night, I would just read all day on the Sunday, these big tomes, it's really difficult to do that now. But I remember I started 1984 on the Saturday, and then I went out, I had a good time, and I woke up on the Sunday, and I was, the way it was. And then I sat down and read 1984 pretty much all the way through. And I finished it at about 9:45 that night. And I was absolutely horrified, like absolutely shook to my core. Because this is before I had the internet. I remember that I thought I was so depressed and so shocked at what had happened and the effect that it had had on my brain, that I actually went down the local pub where I used to go just to sink a few beers and mingle and have a bit of lighthearted banter. I was absolutely appalled, but I was left with a lot of questions as well. And when the movie, which we're going to take a look at, came out, of course, there's going to be a lot of crossover with the book, like I say, because it is such a good adaptation. There's not much in it. But I think there was a general sense that when 1984, the actual year, and this came out in 84, but there was a kind of sense, well, the year 1984 has come and gone, and that didn't happen, and we don't need to worry about this. This is kind of paranoia about some kind of communist dystopia. We don't have to worry about that. We're still free. We're still liberal. Everything's grand. And I feel like I've spent my life watching that being debunked one way or another, especially like the last 25 years. So what did you think of the movie, Endeavour?
Well, I liked the movie, and I actually just recently read the book, only about a month or so ago. So I know that's as shocking as that is to hear. It took me this long to actually get around to reading 1984. But what actually inspired me to pick up and read the book is was basically all the comparisons between this novel and what's going on in particular in the UK. But you can apply that to the West more broadly. It's something which the reason I wasn't so enthusiastic about getting around to reading it earlier is that I guess I kind of just saw it as this tired cliche of modern internet discourse. So my history with this book is totally different from yours. So you, like you mentioned, you read it in 2003 when life was good, and this seemed like something which was absolutely like a horror story for me. When I got around to reading it, I mean, I was already kind of used to it because I was already, you know, quote unquote, red pilled on Clown World over the past couple of years. And I kind of just got around to it because I wanted to comment more on the 1984 as a meme. Because I mean, I was already aware of all of the concepts that were, which George Orwell wrote about in 1984. Words like the thought police, unpersoned, memory hole, all of these concepts have already been part of my lexicon for almost a decade now, but I only recently got around to actually reading the book itself. So, I mean, do I like the book? Yes, I do. I think it's definitely a very well-written book. Do I like the movie? I do actually like the movie a lot, but I actually have a lot of criticisms of both the book itself and kind of its place in the culture. And it's interesting that you chose 1984 for this month, because I just finished writing a two-part essay on dystopian fiction. The first part of my essay was about why dystopian fiction doesn't actually prevent real dystopias. The second part was about, in many ways, dystopian fiction can even facilitate real life dystopias. But we can get into my the takes that I put onto Substack a bit later. I'll hand it over to you to get us started on that one.
Yeah, I think as far as dystopian fiction is concerned, because obviously we've covered a lot of dystopian fiction. And I do. This is, you know, this is kind of like the Lord of the Rings of dystopias. And we've talked about before how, like, what the Lord of the Rings is to fantasy 1984 is to totalitarian dystopias. And to be fair to Orwell, I think they really do go all the way. Like, I think that it's hard to imagine a society worse than this, to be honest. And remember, we've done Rollerball, we've done Mad Max. And we've kind of put them into sections where you can have like a hard dystopia, you can have civilizational crash dystopia, you can have the sort of techno Blade Runner dystopia, and this is like the hard totalitarian dystopia. And despite attempts, it's still like, as my missus would say, the Mac Daddy. It's still like the I think it's. You've also got Brave New World, which came out a little bit before this. But just in terms of the movie, then, what I think's nice, because I think people are going to be aware of the story. We normally go through the story. It's Winston Smith. He's living in a totalitarian, like the most totalitarian society you can ever imagine. But in this case, it's kind of grotty. It is, somebody mentioned in the chat how it's like 1948, which is the year that he wrote it. And at that time, you've got, like in the film, you do have that feel. You do have that feel of squalor. And the little touches where he's rolling a cigarette and the baccy just comes out because it's just all powder. And you've got the telly screens and there's people barking at him all the time. I mean, what one thing they didn't predict was like, it is the whitest film you'll ever see, like, but you know, there's no multiracialism at all, except for if you want to include Goldstein. But he begins to become disillusioned with the system that he's living in. He begins to question its morality. He begins to question the party line. He's employed basically changing headlines and news stories and memory holing and warping truth, with all of this is just as amazingly ahead of its age. Like, and then he begins the love affair and he rebels. Now I do just to sort of get into it a bit. One of the things that I'd kind of take issue with is that you've got the Eurythmics soundtrack to this, which is good, which mainly it's good. You've got a bit of synth there. You've got a bit of kind of 80s sort of unnerving romanticism kind of electronic music, which I think does a good job. But sometimes I think it kind of crosses over the line into where it is just, it kind of dates it. And one of the things that I feel is more in the film than in the book is the way they do it, which is where sex and personal attachment is a kind of rebellion against the system. Now, that is in the book, but I do think they kind of overemphasize it a little bit in the movie, because in a 1980s audience, it speaks to a kind of liberalism in a way. Is the only way you can rebel that... Julia makes a big thing about how many times she's done that. Again, I've got to be careful because this is in the book. But I think combined with the Eurythmics sort of music, it is kind of saying that, well, in actual fact, like, if you abandon any kind of morality, you can express your individualism and your freedom. And just watching it again recently, that did kind of chaff a little bit, but I wouldn't make too much out of it. And then as we move on, you've got the amazing, brilliant Richard Burton as O'Brien, and the horrific torture scenes which go in. Another little change from this, I think, is in the book, the kind of the Goldstein manifesto on oligarchical power. In the book, that's like pages and pages and pages of exposition on how the world ended up like this. And in the film, it's just a couple of lines. But I'll give it a pass because Richard Burton looked like death. Yeah, I think he was actually dying of cancer at the time. But I'll give the kind of how brief they deal with the Goldstein book itself, I'll give that a bit of a pass because it is difficult to do that in a movie. It's, you don't want them just, they do it a little bit, which is we get his thoughts, but at the end of the day, you don't want him lying in a bed reading like pages and pages of text of Julia. That fits a novel, but it doesn't fit with a film. So I'll give it a pass for that as well. I mean, I just can't really fault it. I think it's just a perfectly like solid and kind of minimalistic and at times brilliant exploration of the original text.
One thing I will say is that I really like the color scheme because it's just so depressing, because the entire world, this is supposed to take place in London, but the entire world is just this kind of gray slate color. Everyone is wearing these kind of grayish bluish slate overalls, and it really just, and then whenever he's walking outside, there are no trees, there's no nothing, it's just all this rubble, because of course Oceania is constantly at war with one of the two other great powers. And you do get the sense that almost everything good about life, almost everything that makes life worth living, is just totally gone in this world. But then there are the scenes with where he's in the fields. There's a scene where he's dreaming at the end, and you see this bright green field, and it's almost a relief to actually see something else in the color palette, because you're just so used to seeing gray everywhere. And then of course there are the scenes with Julia. I mean, maybe we can get into that a bit later. But the other thing that I think the movie did really well is that all of the telescreens, I think that's what they're called in the novel, right? Telescreens? So
Yeah.
So the thing you see in the picture here, it's some like face on TV. And it feels like everywhere Winston goes, there's one of these things just barking out propaganda and just spewing this political diatribe. And it gives you this sense of this like never ending screech of just the state imposing itself upon every aspect of your life through these devices. And I mean, it's annoying, but it kind of actually plays into the film, because you get the sense that like it's just this never ending annoyance, which is just ever present in your life, and you really just. I got to the point where I just desperately wanted these stupid telescreens to go away.
You also get Orwell does a lot of clever trickery in this. You can see, like, he's he's well, this deserves, I know it's a meme and I know everything, but this, it deserves the reputation that it has. There's all of the little tricks in the like the bit where people keep asking him if he has a razor blade spare because there's a shortage of razor blades. And he has to come up, and two people ask him, and he gives them both different excuses. One of them, he says, "Oh, sorry, I've only got one left," which is Gregor Fisher, who is, I believe it's Parsons, who he plays. That's Rab C. Nesbitt for anybody of a certain age in the chat. He plays like the quintessential normie, the absolute sort of subservient, no agency, no free will, completely dominated intellectually and spiritually by the party, by the system. And he tells him, "Well, I've only got one razor blade left." And then a little bit later, Smythe or somebody asks him, and he says, "I'm sorry, I'm on the last one." And it's the way that they've got to sort of carefully like lie. And then you actually see the razor blade that he's got. And it's just this sort of chunk of rust. It's just everything. Everything's grotty. Everything's run down and horrible. And there's just like bomb explosions going off. They're just having normal conversations, and there's bombs going off in the background. I think this is why it feels so thoroughly depressing. You know, when you look at other dystopias like Blade Runner and that, it's kind of glossy. It's neon lights and everything. But this just looks absolutely horrific. It's just so run down and shitty.
Oh, yeah. You do get this feeling of hopelessness. I feel that that's one thing that the film really does well is you just don't really, you don't feel any hope anywhere. There just seems like there's absolutely nothing that out there, maybe other than Julia herself, that actually seems to make life worth living for Winston. You do get the sense of him kind of becoming disillusioned with the system, but also that there's just very little out there for him to actually hold on to. I've always liked the detail in the book where the old man, who eventually turns out to be working for the Thought Police, I've always liked the detail where he had that poem about St. Clemens. I think the line, it was something like the oranges and lemons are the bells of St. Clemens. It goes on from there. But I've always liked the aspect of the story that this is something which Winston, he latches on to this little poem because it's describing, first of all, something which existed before, in the before times, before the revolution, before the regime of Oceania. But it's also something which it's poetic in a way. It's something which is poetic and describing something which actually gives life some kind of value. I've always liked that. I've always liked that little detail of the story that's kind of something which Winston grabs onto. But then, of course, later on, it's revealed that this guy who was told that is actually part of the Thought Police. And what that did for me, at least, was any hope that you had, it just pulled the rug right out from under it. So you had this hope that there was this old guy out there who he remembered the before times. And, you know, when he was a young guy, he would have been walking down the street on a sunny day and seen this beautiful cathedral and that, you know, life would have actually been good. But then, you know, now all that's gone away. But what ends up happening is it kind of builds that hope in your mind, but then just dashes it right away when you find out that, in fact, that guy was just working for the Thought Police.
Yeah, this is a running theme. I mean, there's a couple of people in the chat talking about the year 1948. So this is the year, I believe, when the NHS came in, or was at 47. But it was at this stage where you've got that kind of post-war malaise in Britain where rationing stuck around in Britain for years and years. And there was this exhaustion, this sort of run. So that I think that it is a good point to say that did obviously influence so Orwell's perspective of thing. But just on the idea of the poem, so you do see this, you do get this throughout the whole thing, which is that the gaps, what we're looking for is gaps where the party doesn't exist or doesn't influence things. So obviously Julia is one of them. And Julia's sort of, what do you call it when women sleep around a lot? What's that called again? It's a fact that there's... Well, yeah, you can call it that, but there's a promiscuous. Julia is promiscuous as her act of rebellion against the party. And what they're looking for is love and meaning and sensual activity, which is not under the sort of not mandated by the party. But that's only one example. Another one is the poem that you read. Another one is they've got one of those little snow globes. There's a picture of a cathedral on the wall. There's certain words which are being brushed out of the language. We'll get to that in a moment. But then you've also got, when they're in the secret den, there's a kind of fat prole woman, and she's singing outside. But the song that she's singing is actually was written by a machine. So they've got machines which are making the music for people. But yet, despite that, when this prole woman, I'm going to assume people know the basics. You've got this huge sort of mass of plebeian proles who are allowed free. They're allowed, as it goes, the freedom of intellect because they don't have an intellect. And then above them, you've got the outer party, which Winston Smith and Julia are both in. Most of the people we see are in. And then at the top, you've got the inner party, which is O'Brien, is the only one we see. They wear black uniforms, I think, and the rest of them wear these bluish gray ones. But the point is, what you get is these expressions of poetry and whimsy, which are outside of party doctrine. And even when the party creates music for the proles, if it's actually in the human voice, then Winston Smith is saying, actually, it's beautiful, despite the fact he knows that it was created by a machine. But when it's given that sort of human touch of freedom and the human spirit, then it can, even that sort of dreck from a machine, this prole feed rubbish, even that can take on its own kind of beauty and poetry to it. And so this is kind of a message which is going on within it. The problem is, as I was saying, you've alluded to, is that Orwell has layered the plot very carefully with all kinds of traps. And these traps are there so that you get your hopes up and you think there's a way out. And there's a lot of different ways that this is sort of embroidered into the story, into the narrative. The ultimate one being, of course, Goldstein's book, but also just the idea that this little house where they're having a love affair is somehow... like somehow the party doesn't know about that. So somehow the party is unaware that you're lying there naked together, reading each other dissident literature, critiquing the system, and so you think, well, they've got this little space, they've got this little secret space where they can be together. And of course, it's all a sham. They're being watched all. So here the trap just shuts straight away, literally. And you get that horrible, chilling moment when they're looking at each other and they're contemplating it. They're saying the prole woman who was singing the song, she belongs to the living, whereas they belong to the dead. And then the kind of the speaker on the wall, which is the party, bursts out and says, "You are the dead." And they're like, okay, that's it. That's the end of it. And they say, we're going to have to say goodbye. And all the goons come in and all of this kind of thing. And this is a recurring thing. And it's like Orwell's absolutely adamant that you will be blackpilled by this. Like, you're not another big cope that Winston has, which O'Brien taunts him about, is the idea that sooner or later the proles are going to rise up against the system. Because there's so many millions of them, the whole thing with the disorganized mass and Winston's like that they'll you can't keep them down forever. Sooner or later they'll rise up and they'll put you in your place. They'll bring this rotten system all the way down. And O'Brien's like, of course they won't. Of course they won't. they are allowed intellectual freedom because they don't have an intellect. We took care of that a long time ago. And you get on, just to sort of get back to the subject of human emotion and feeling, he goes to a kind of speech that's a presentation thing, and at INSOC, and you realize just how insane this system is, where they're talking about they've got their scientists at work because they're going to abolish the orgasm. And what that, again, it gets back to the problem that they do not want people thinking or feeling of their own volition or having connections with each other. So you'll see, for example, and this gets into a little bit of the sort of takes on Trotsky and communism and stuff, but you'll see that they're also in the process of abolishing the family, because if somebody is married, they've got children, they've got connections and bonds which are not to the party, so the family has to go. And so he's really gone like all in on the totalitarianism. There's nothing outside of the party, but sometimes you will be led into these cul-de-sacs and traps where he's allowing you to get your, oh, maybe the proles are going to rise up and take over. Oh, look, they've got this secret little love nest, you know, where they can read like dissident literature to each other. Oh, and one after the other, they're just slammed in your face. Like, this is brilliant writing, though. Good God, it's bleak.
I mean, yeah, the one thing that I just fundamentally disagree with is that hope lies in the proles, because, I mean, as we've seen in the real world ourselves, that what we call the normie just seems to have almost zero agency whatsoever. I mean, how many examples do we have? I mean, you can look over the course of the last 50, 60 years, not to get too much into present day politics, but to get to where we are today, where we are starting to feel like 1984 might actually be reflecting the world that we live in now. Now, we can talk about later why the world we live in is not like 1984 and the differences. However, despite all that, like the slide to where we are today, there never has once been a pushback from the proles, our version of the proles, that being the normies. And I mean, we can get into why that's the case, but I just fundamentally disagree that that's where someone should leave their hope. Because if I were in Winston's shoes, I think that the hope would have to come from somebody within the party actually deciding to stage a coup against Big Brother and deciding to like form some kind of counter elite against them, kind of like what the character of Goldstein is portrayed as doing. I mean, I don't know exactly if I'd put much hope in somebody named Goldstein in real life, but that's neither here nor there. I think though that like the idea that there is this hope that a society is just, it's so totalitarian that eventually there's going to be this uprising of the normies, and they're going to just overthrow it because this unjust, controlling, oppressive system can't last forever. Well, what I'll say is that look at something like North Korea. I mean, that's gone on for almost 80 years now. And the average person in North Korea, it doesn't look like there's any appearance that there's going to be some uprising in North Korea anytime soon. Not that I know, not that I'm an expert on that country, but I just think it's fundamentally incorrect to believe that a system being so bad is going to necessitate that there's going to be this uprising of the average citizens, which is going to overthrow it eventually. I think that's just not the case.
Well, yeah, so we can discount the proles, just looking at the sort of how the system maintains stability. We can discount the proles because they're disorganized and they're not very smart, but there is a lot of them. And so the next kind of tier of the system will be the outer party, which is where Winston Smith is. Now, how do you do that? Well, what you do there is create a false opposition. You contain it. So if there's any dissident intellects, if the people who are intellectually curious and want to organize and facilitate in the long term a revolution, what they've actually done is provide that for them. It's truly horrific. So when I was reading the book, or this is why I do think the film's great. It's the aesthetics and everything are spot on. But there's a reason why, like, I think there must be about 30 pages or something of Goldstein's manual in the book. And what it does is explain the law. It explains the law. It explains why things are the way they are. And it gives a kind of timescale. And so what you are then, as the reader, and as Winston, you're kind of put in the position of Winston Smith in that moment. And we kind of know this in our scene, because you are then in the situation of reading literature and being confronted with ideas which fundamentally critique the system that you're living under. And so you can think, this is it. This is the golden ticket. This is, I've read Kevin MacDonald, or I've read Oswald Spengler, or I've read The Elite Theorists, or whatever you want. And you can think, this is now explaining to me why the world is the way it is. And so there's always going to be kind of dissident intellects out there who are going to be interested in that kind of thing. And what happens in 1984 is that you, as in the situation of Winston Smith, you go along with this. So you are thinking, right, okay, so this is it. This is the answer to why this god-awful system existed. And he really takes it apart. He really deconstructs it. And then in the end, when Smith is being tortured by O'Brien, all of his other copes are being swept aside. All of his other illusions are being, like, he's being tortured. But more than that, it's, and this is in the book as well, it's that O'Brien is intellectually superior to Winston Smith. So he's already aware of what he's read. He already, and in the end, he says, well, the underground underground network of revolutionaries following Goldstein, they will bring you down. Like, that is inevitable. And then O'Brien says, no, they won't. I wrote the book. Well, he said, well, it was a joint effort, but there was me and some other inner party acolytes. We wrote the book. The book that you are putting all of your hope in. We wrote it.
Oh God.
It's so bad. It's and then you see it in Winston Smith's eyes, and it's just like, that's it. I think that's when he says, well, the proles will still be there, or something like that. But it's like, we're going to sprinkle a little bit of optimism in front of you, and then we're just going to snatch it away and club your head in with a stick. It's really brutal. Like, this is the thing, when a kind of something within the culture becomes a meme and it becomes a kind of parody of itself. You know, this, 1984 was meant to be a warning, not a guidebook, and all of these kind of, you're right, it is cliche. But in a way, it kind of takes away the potency and the harshness of the actual original.
Oh yeah, I didn't get that in the story, but I'm under the impression that Goldstein doesn't even exist. That he's just like he was a fabrication, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just all made up.
O'Brien was the one who even wrote him and fabricated the entire character.
Yeah, he's just a complete false opposition. So what they do then, and to be fair, the actual communists did this as well, let's be honest, it's happening in the West, I believe, as well, where what it is that, well, we know our system is going to create intellectuals, in this case, who are going to start and critique it and start and question it, and then eventually they'll be networking and organizing against it. So in order to preempt that state of affairs, we will write the critique of our own system and hand it to them in secret. And so the book is actually, it's like a book within a book. The pages are stuck together and you peel it open and you get this kind of sense, oh, now this is it. Now we're going to discover the truth about what the hell happened here. And then you realize that actually It's all fake. They've accounted for that as well. So they are leading the opposition and then culling it as soon as it gets to a certain point. I mean, when you actually drill down into the whole changing the past and all of that, I've got to tread carefully here because you do see him as a young boy. You do see his own memories going back to his childhood. But there is a case that you could make that you don't even know that it is 1984. How do we know what year it is? How do we know how old this system is when truth is just being abolished and remade and then repackaged and then that gets flushed away and the new truth is constructed? You don't actually know what year it is.
I mean, I got that feeling in the scene with the old man as well. So I was wondering when I was reading the story and then watching the movie as well, did this man actually live before the revolution? Because later on, it's shown that he is a member of the Thought Police, meaning that if he didn't, if he did in fact live before the revolution, then he would have had to have all that prior knowledge and then forsake all of that in order to basically become a servant of the system. Now, that's not totally inconceivable because as we can see in the real world today, there are a lot of older people who remember the world before Global Homo, who are a lot of times very loud advocates of advocates of the world that we're living in today, even though they would have lived in a world earlier and would have, I think they wouldn't have had to live with all the ills which have been brought about by the system over the past couple of decades. But despite that, they actually do still support the system. Now, I guess I can get into later on why I think that is, but that aspect of the story did get me to question, was this man actually alive before the revolution? So did he actually wear a top hat at his relative's funeral? Did he actually ever get into this argument on the street with a capitalist who bumped him or something like that? Did he ever actually know these poems? Did he ever actually see these cathedrals in London? Or was that all just made up? Because you also get in the movie that Winston doesn't remember his childhood, so he has very little memory of his life as a young boy. Because I'm pretty sure that in the story he would have been born around 1945, so just at the end of World War II, and then the revolution in the story would have been just a couple of years later. So that Winston is older than the regime, but he was a child when it was founded, meaning that he would have very little memory. You kind of see him like trying to grasp onto, well, what was it like when I was a young boy? What was my mother like? But then again, there's a question: did any of that even happen?
Well, I think what's happened there is that the reason why they did the flashbacks with Winston is to set up that his deepest fear is rats. You know, he sees like his mother being eaten by rats and his sister disappeared, this kind of thing. And he associates all that with his deepest sort of fears. And I think the reason why that's in is because then later, when he goes into room 101, they've established why he hates rats so much. I mean, just to touch on that as well, in room 101, room 101 is where they will finally break you. They will torture you. You are going to, in the book, Orwell describes it where when they put you on a rack and it feels as, like the pain is so severe that it feels like your spine is going to snap. This isn't a happy book. He raises a fair point to O'Brien. Why do this? Why not just kill me? Just shoot me. And O'Brien says, because that's too easy. That's not enough. What they're doing is going to remake him so that he genuinely does love Big Brother. It's not enough that they just kill their enemies. They have to convert their enemies into loving Big Brother. They have to creep inside. There's elements of Winston within him that they want out. So this is why it's so important that they get him and Julia to turn on each other. When him and Julia are in the secret love nest, they say, Julia says, look, they can't make us hate each other. No matter what they do, they can't go that deep inside of us. And of course, they do exactly that. When Winston says, don't do it to me, do it to Julia, he means it. This is the tragedy of it. He really means it. He's been completely broken. There's nothing left. So in that way, it's just, yeah, he's just given it up. He loves Big Brother now. And O'Brien says, once you love Big Brother genuinely and truly with all of your heart, that's when we'll shoot you. And it just beggars belief that how shocking it is. Now, what I was going to do here before we get on to like dystopia more generally in your recent articles is that I've got my copy of 1984, and I've seen a few people mentioning James Burnham in the chat, which I do find this because this is why I think 1984 is really relevant to kinds of ways of thinking that we are, which have caught on in our circles, which I think are good. And it opens up an interesting discussion. And in my copy of 1984, it's on page 235. And I'm going to read part of the Goldstein text. So this is the dissident text within which explains the world and everything. And then we'll have a look at the managerial revolution, which I've got here as well, because my copy of that, Orwell gives a lengthy foreword, and I've marked out a little. This fascinates me, what happens here. So this is 1984, and in Goldstein's text, it says, what kind of people would control this world had been equally obvious. The new this also, by the way, is why so many of us are interested in managerialism in these circles. The new aristocracy was made up of the most part of bureaucrats, scientists, technicians, trade union organizers, publicity experts, sociologists, teachers, journalists, and professional politicians. These people, whose origins lay in the salaried middle class and the upper grades of the working class, had been shaped and brought together by the barren world of monopoly industry and centralized government. As compared with their opposite numbers in past ages, they were less avaricious, less tempted by luxury, hungrier for pure power, and above all, more conscious of what they were doing and more intent on crushing opposition. This last difference was cardinal. By comparison with that existing today, all the tyrannies of the past were half-hearted and inefficient. The ruling groups were always infected to some extent by liberal ideas and were content to leave loose ends everywhere to regard only the overt act to be uninterested in what their subjects were thinking. Even the Catholic Church of the Middle Ages was tolerant by modern standards. Part of the reason for this was that in the past, no government had the power to keep its citizens under constant surveillance. The invention of print, however, made it easier to manipulate public opinion, and the film and the radio carried the process further. With the development of television and the technical advance which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument, private life came to an end. Every citizen, or at least every citizen important enough to be worth watching, could be kept for 24 hours a day under the eyes of the police and of the sound of official propaganda, with all other channels of communication closed. The possibility of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity of opinion on all subjects now existed for the first time. So remember, this is Goldstein explaining, this is the dissident book within 1984, which they want the counter-revolutionaries, the dissidents, to engage themselves in, which it could be completely accurate. It probably is. It's probably, this is the thing, it probably is true. And a little sort of side take was that he occupies a similar role to Trotsky in relation to Stalin, I suppose. But it really does kind of highlight what this system is. and it's a managerial system. And in what I think is fascinating when you see what I've just read is a shorter passage here by George Orwell, Second Thoughts on James Burnham. So James Burnham wrote a book in 1940 called The Managerial Revolution. And he said the basic gist of it is that the future will not be capitalist or socialist. It will be the bureaucrats and the technicians and the experts, trust the experts, who occupy all the key nodes in the power structure, because they are the organizers and the doers, and the kind of, you know, it's all being carried on these middle management types. And he said eventually the system will be completely reliant on them, and what they will create is a system where the old capitalists would be displaced. So you can think of it sort of like, say, the Ford Foundation, where you end up with just like an NGO with a bunch of bureaucrats running it instead of this entrepreneur. You can see, for example, Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter is a rare victory of the old capitalist entrepreneur, maybe, over the managerial classes, and they are now looking to manage and regulate him back into line. That's the world in which we live in, and this is what I'm getting to here, is that I think the argument that 1984 and Orwell himself is a criticism and almost like a dark satire of James Burnham's managerial revolution, and here. On Second Thoughts on James Burnham by George Orwell, there's a lengthy foreword in the book that I have, and he says, what is now arising is a new kind of planned centralized society which will neither be capitalist nor, in any accepted sense of the word, democratic. The rulers of this new society will be the people who effectively control the means of production, that is, business executives, technicians, bureaucrats, and soldiers, lumped together by Burnham under the name of managers. These people will eliminate the old capitalist class, crush the working class, and so organize society that all power and economic privilege remain in their own hands. Private property rights will be abolished, but common ownership will not be established. The new managerial societies will not consist of a patchwork of small independent states, but of great super states grouped around the main industrial centers in Europe, Asia, and America. So here, which we haven't even touched on yet, is the geographic sort of side of this, which I think we're heading into as we speak. And the superstates will fight amongst themselves for possession of the remaining uncaptured portions of the earth, but will probably be unable to conquer one another completely. Internally, each society will be hierarchical, with an aristocracy of talent at the top and a mass of semi-slaves at the bottom. So that's kind of my take on that. I think it's really interesting to think of 1984 in those terms, and I just wanted to hit on that in the stream.
Well, it's interesting because have you read the Sam Francis's book Leviathan and Its Enemies?
No, I haven't, but I have heard of it. But yeah,
so I'll be honest, I didn't actually finish James Burnham's book because, I mean, I think he was an interesting thinker, but I found the book just dreadfully boring. To be honest, I felt like I had the idea before when I'm about a quarter of the way through. But I did read the entire length of Sam Francis's book Leviathan and Its Enemies, and this is kind of a follow-up to James Burnham, written 50 years later. So Burnham wrote The Managerial Revolution in the 1940s. Sam Francis wrote Leviathan and Its Enemies in the 1990s. And basically, it's a look at the managerial revolution 50 years on. So what Francis does is that he classifies regimes of the 20th century, things like the Soviet Union or National Socialist Germany, he classifies these as hard managerialism. And how he classifies Western liberal democracies like the United States or Britain in the early 90s, he classifies them as soft managerialism. And there is a very fundamental difference between the two, because I know that what you're describing is how 1984 does actually reflect the world we live in today. I think that what's interesting about Francis's book is it kind of describes the differences where these diverge. So a hard managerialism, it's run by this massive state apparatus. There's going to be probably one party rule. There's going to be some political doctrine which mandates loyalty to the system itself. It creates some kind of meta narrative which gets all of the citizens to have a fierce loyalty to this, to the system. And it's all backed up by the constant threat of force. So something like the Stalinist Soviet Union, which was Orwell's inspiration for writing 1984, that definitely is a hard totalitarianism. It's a hard, a hard managerialism, as Sam Francis would have described it. So there was this official state ideology. There was this one great leader. There was a massive state bureaucracy. Everything was run by the state, and it was backed up by the ever-present threat of force. When you just look at how many people were executed in during Stalin's reign, I mean, that just kind of goes without saying. A soft managerial system is a bit different. It's not a facilitate. It doesn't uphold itself with the constant threat of force. But rather what it does is it upholds itself with kind of a propaganda through mass media and through manipulation and through mass hedonism. So the morality of a soft managerial system is basically that of this individualist liberation kind of morality, which we're pretty much living under today in the West. And this the way that it controls people is by changing the priorities in their life. So he talks about the bourgeois world order, which existed before the managerial revolution, where things like loyalty to the family, loyalty to one's nation, personal responsibility, things like this. Francis describes these as bourgeois values, and that managerial values kind of undermine those, and they really vilify them and try to destroy these things which give people a loyalty to something immaterial. But the soft managerial system doesn't mandate this unending loyalty to the state like you would have seen in something like the Soviet Union. What it does is it kind of just it placates people by offering them this hedonism where their entire sense of identity and their entire sense of purpose, it just kind of becomes their the consumer products which they happen to like, and that really is what fills that role. And kind of instead of like demanding loyalty to the state, it really just kind of placates people by dumbing them down and softening them up and making them these kind of hedonistic, materialistic consumers. And what Sam Francis wrote is the real weakness of soft managerialism is that it can't really exert coercive force like a hard managerial system can. So let's say that there were a war. Now I know there's the aspect of nuclear weapons, but let's just put that aside for a moment. How would a Western liberal democracy actually get people to actually go off to war for it? They would have an extremely difficult time doing that. I know you've made that video and written that essay about the prospect of conscription in the UK, that it just seems like it's a total joke because absolutely no one has a loyalty to the state anymore. Nobody has a loyalty to the broader society because everything which, first of all, because the demographics have been shifted, but also everything which would have made men loyal to their countries in past decades and centuries, all of that has been undermined and it's all been subverted and deconstructed. And now there's nothing. And a soft managerial system will have a lot harder time actually getting people on board to do something like war or even do some grander projects. And and Francis identifies that as the main weakness of soft managerialism. What I'll say is that I feel that his description of soft managerialism describes the world we're living in today a lot more accurately, whereas the hard managerialism, that does describe a system like 1984, but I feel that that is a fundamental difference between 1984 as shown in the novel and the movie versus the actual world we live in today.
Yes. I mean, just to do, which is related to this, it's interesting that I don't like to touch on current thing kind of stuff on these streams, but it is we've now got these kinds of scandal going on about how right wing influencers were bought and paid for by Russia, and there's some big channels being pulled down, and it's only just beginning. And I actually think this is probably going to be like a wider sort of witch hunt to root out wrong thinkers within the sort of online right wing scene ahead of the election, maybe, or maybe it's just sort of clearing the decks before things get worse with Russia and everything. And of course, there's a bit of a paradox with that, because why, at the end of the day, is what is the problem? If you're living in a liberal society, surely it doesn't matter. Like, surely, if it just in terms of spreading ideas around, I thought it was all about being able to take the sort of ruminate over the other side and this kind of, and of course you find that when it does come to war or tensions around the world, then actually all of that goes out the window. It's such a cynical age. You don't really know like what the play is here. I mean, I've been accused of being a Russia shill, despite the fact that I don't have any content, I haven't really got any content on it either way. I've made a couple of posts about how horrible drone warfare is, or that both of them are in this postmodern kind of low fertility stage and all of this. But I don't really care. And I did a podcast with Frody Midyard a while ago, and he openly sort of supports Ukraine, which is fine. And my take on this is that what we're seeing are these civilizational problems. And this brings us to what, you know, when you look at all of the coordination and going on with Russia and China, and you see the West is also trying to get its act together. And my kind of take on this is like what we're heading into is where you have not three as in 1984, but certainly two massive geopolitical blocks which are on lockdown and which won't want ideas and technology slipping from back and forth. And so this, again, I think is another vindication, because people tend to forget the wider geopolitical elements to 1984, where there's these three blocks in the world, and they have these sort of performative wars where, yeah, there's millions of people are dying, but not that many. It's not a sort of all or nothing World War II sort of. It's more like this constant long dirge of just switching sides and making things up. Of course, you never know what's true and what isn't. I think that's fine, because what that does is provide a justification, as if one was needed in Oceania, to clamp down on people even more. So then they say, well, we've got this big bad enemy out there, and therefore we need to clamp down on yet even further on heretics. And you wonder, when they break their own rules like this, you can kind of ask, well, how far is this going to go? What happens? Because it's all very well saying a soft managerial system can't actually sort of take the gloves off, but they are doing that more and more. And I mean, I know obviously someone like Lauren Chen isn't going to jail or anything yet, but we can see that they're having to deal with this. They're having to deal with the restless millions upon millions of restless population in their own territory, while at the same time facing off of these people abroad. And I feel as if we're reaching a point where the kind of the soft managerial power is really struggling to hold the line.
Yeah, and one thing that Francis does say in his book is that he thinks that soft managerialism have to make a transition to hard managerialism eventually, because he says when it's actually put to the test, which this was 1992, I think, which he wrote it. So this was just after the Cold War, but it never really had been put to the test in any real way. And who knows, maybe we'll see that now, but I think it's a system which is going to prove to be very ineffective at in effect of that actually managing a crisis. And we'll see that there could be this shift towards a more hard managerial system. I mean, one thing you pointed out that someone like Lauren Chen is possibly facing criminal charges. I mean, I certainly hope that that's not the direction things are going. Now, I mean, I'm someone who actually spent several years working and living in Russia, working for a Russian company. I know I've never had any association with the Russian state in any way, shape, or form. I've never received a dollar from them, and I've tried to make it clear to people that I'm neutral in the whole war in Ukraine. I've tried to be objective about the whole thing from the start. But let's say that there actually is a war. Will the Canadian government look through my passport and see all these visas, and then that's like, look at that. Here's a traitor off to the gulags. That's something I certainly have to worry about going forward. But that aside, I think that I do wonder if the West today would actually be able to pull off something like you see in 1984, where they're just constantly at war. So in the book, they also famously have that the idea that, well, they're at war with East Asia one day and their allies with Eurasia, then the next day they're at war with Eurasia and East Asia is their allies. And it is interesting how they play it off that that's changed, and then nobody is even supposed to notice that they're saying the complete opposite of what they were saying the day earlier. But the point I wanted to make, though, is that I do wonder, would Western governments actually be able to maintain something like that, like this state of war? It doesn't have to be this a world war, even just like a regional thing. I think they'd actually have to have some kind of ideology which encourages loyalty to the state. Because one other thing that I think is very different between 1984 and the real world today is that the ideology of Ingsoc doesn't really matter in the story. It's all about loyalty to the state. It's all about absolute devotion to Big Brother as this godlike leader, as this godlike figure. And it just feels like Ingsoc is, it doesn't really even matter what that ideology is. What it just comes down to is loyalty to the state. The world we live in today, I don't feel that's the case, really, that nobody is really expected to be loyal to some kind of leader or to be loyal to their state. I mean, it's not expected of people to actually join the military or actually serve, have any kind of perform any kind of civic duty. That's not expected of people at all. What is expected of people is loyalty to the ideology of diversity, equity, and inclusion, of global homo, whatever you want to call it. That's what's actually enforced. Like the actual leaders themselves, they come and go. It just feels like they're just like it just feels like the actual national leaders of these countries are just middle managers. Now, I do think that there exist people who are above them, like let's say, for example, someone like Larry Fink at BlackRock. But we're not being made to worship Larry Fink. Most people don't even know who he is. It's an idea. The ideology and the actual tenets of the ideology seem to be a lot more important than whoever is in power, or whoever the leader is in the state itself. Whereas in 1984, it's entirely like the actual ideology doesn't matter. It's all just loyalty to the state.
Well, so you can see this in the kind of the debate over woke, where when they want to kind of break down all of the cultural barriers around the world and kind of infest the world with rainbow flags and transsexualism and gay parades and anti-whiteness, George Floyd statues, all the rest of it, like they were fine with that. But now that the immune sort of defenses of these foreign states have kicked into action, and I'd say, okay, we get what that is. We're going to shut down the NGOs. We're going to push back against this. We understand what's happening here. Then it leaves them kind of high and dry. And so if you are rational, then you may find that, well, what we really need is to go back to the 90s if we can. I don't think it matters anymore, because real world sort of like the realities of everyday life out in a shopping center and in a high street are just too far gone for anybody.
It is going to be impossible to go back to the 1990s.
You can perform it on media and social media. But, you know, if you are just walking down the shopping street, if you're even if you're going out for a walk in the countryside and living your life, it's impossible to get away from this in real raw terms now, or at least it's very difficult. But from this perspective, you can see that there is an advantage of having the sort of the Trump come in. And you can I can imagine there'd be more of a positive vision around that. And it's kind of like I was thinking earlier, if you look at the American election, you kind of get the disparity between the managerial classes, which is the Democrats. You can see in who supports them. And then you've also got this kind of capitalist entrepreneurial class with people like Musk, the tech bros, and Trump himself. All of them are. It's a little bit grey because if you're honest, they're all taking a good bit of coin off the American deep state for weapons manufacturing, satellite systems, and all of this kind of thing. But all right, okay, fair enough. It is in a way. People saying, look, all of this managerial work nonsense is leading us to ruin. We're losing out on technology and AI systems of China in the long term. We're not able to get boots on the ground. We're not able to exert hard power. This nonsense needs to be shown the door. But still, you would have the sort of the, this is the soft managerialism trying to reconfigure itself, whereas just an out-and-out hard managerialism kind of wouldn't. I mean, even Stalin had to do that in World War II to a degree. He had to bring back a bit of patriotism. But I think it's important to just to get back to 1984, where if you say, what actually is the ideology of Oceania? What is the ideology of Big Brother? And in the end, it's just power. it really is just power. There's nothing there. And this is why I think as a critique of Burnham's thinking, you know, the Machiavellians and the managerial revolution, it's actually quite on point, because it's as if once you kind of brush past all the smoke and mirrors, and once you, there's actually nothing there but a kind of cynical, inhuman sort of just crush everybody. There's just this, just nothing but power. There's nothing but an iron fist. There's no velvet glove. There's no pretense of any of it. It's just worship Big Brother, worship the avatar of power. That's it. That's as complicated as the ideology gets. And it, as a kind of criticism of elite theory, as it's called now, it's quite a good one, to be honest, because it's saying, well, you know, it's kind of hollow and it's wrong and it's not right.
Well, yeah, I just feel like I don't know if that's entirely the way that it always works, because I do find that even managerial systems, even systems which do exert a huge amount of power upon the populace, there always seems to be this kind of underlying worldview which they need to legitimize it. I mean, in our world, it's even though it is a soft managerialism, we still have one. In our world, it's woke. That's basically the ideology of the managerial class. In the hard managerialism of something like the Soviet Union or National Socialist Germany, they had their own respective ideologies. The Soviet Union had communism, National Socialist Germany had National Socialism. I do feel like there still has to be this kind of underlying worldview which legitimizes it. I'm not one of these people that thinks it's all just pure cynicism, that the actual belief system of the people in power doesn't actually matter. That's all just to justify power. I know that there was that back and forth between Keith Woods and Academic Agent a few years ago on this very topic. Now, I think both of them made a lot of good points, but I wouldn't go so far as someone like Academic Agent to say that it's all just post hoc justification for power. I think there's a lot of that. I do think that power, as Bertrand de Juvenal wrote, is that it's always self-interested. But I do think that there is like an essence, there is some kind of essence to that, which does color the system which it actually ends up creating. So I don't know if I would agree that and the actual the actual substance of the worldview doesn't matter whatsoever, and that it's all about power. I don't think that is entirely accurate.
I think it has to be seen as a means to an end. So let's just say if my ideology is to do what's right for the British people, then okay, that I can't actually do that if I don't have power. But if I did have power, that's what I would do. But that would be the reason why I saw power. Orwell's criticism of Burnham is that he's saying the only reason anybody would actually look to get power would be to have power. But like, that would be it. And then as an afterthought, you begin sort of casting around looking for a formula. Whereas what he's done in 1984, say they didn't even bother doing that. it's just there raw. And without the baubles and the Christmas lights, it's just raw power. But anyway, to sort of move on a little bit from the discussion, because we spent quite a long time on the sort of managerialism and all of that. You did some Substack articles touching on the sort of the phenomena of 1984 as a meme. I think it's an interesting subject, how because we know that 1984 exists, it's kind of like it can't happen. It can't happen because everybody's familiar with it. I don't think that's the case. It is happening and the book still exists. They've got a feminist version of it out or something like that.
Yeah, well, what got me thinking about this was that when there was the recent unrest in the UK following the knife attack back in at the end of July, and there was the unrest in August, which was of course followed up by a severe crackdown by the British state, where I think it's over 1,000 people now have been arrested in relation to this unrest. And some people have been arrested for simply social media posts alone. So not even going out and rioting, just posting something on social media about it. And yet again, like I've seen this happen dozens of times already, people out on Twitter were comparing Britain today to 1984. And to me, this kind of just struck me as not as actual as this cutting, brilliant political commentary, but really just more of a tired cliche of modern political discourse on the internet, because I've lost track of the amount of times where I've heard something compared to 1984, whether be it from our guys, be it from the normie right, and even the left as well. People have to remember that 1984 is an extremely popular book. It was banned in the Soviet Union, but in the West, it's never come under any kind of censorship at all. And it's a book which everyone seems to know about. So we could do this stream without having to give too much of a preface on what the story is about, because it seems like everybody knows about it. And it's not even just, it's not even just 1984, but the entire dystopian fiction genre. It's extremely popular today. There are dozens of these being made every year. And a lot of these things have kind of become cornerstones of our culture. So the question is, well, why is that? Well, is it because people are starting to sense that the world that we live in is starting to reflect one of these dystopian fictions? And I came to the conclusion that that is not the reason that it's popular. Because what you'll see is that a lot of times people who are the most loud, doctrinaire enforcers of the ideological orthodoxy of the West, that being woke today, many times they're fans of the genre as well. Many times they've read 1984. Many times they'll compare something Donald Trump does or says to 1984. And I think that there's this misconception that the idea is that if 1984, the novel exists, someone's going to read the novel and be horrified by it, as you mentioned that you were at the beginning of the stream. And that as a result of that, they're going to think critically about the systems which govern them, and that they'll be able to see through dystopia when it actually exists in the real world. And that's just not the case. My argument for why that's not the case is that I think that people have to understand how legitimacy works, because people aren't these rational beings who will objectively consider all the evidence and then come to some well-reasoned conclusion on any given subject, much less on the governance of the society which they live in. When someone reads a book like 1984, the idea is already put in their mind that the system that that is being described is illegitimate. It's being told to the reader that this system is corrupt, oppressive, violent, and that it basically just crushes any kind of genuine human, flourishment is just absolutely crushed by the system. That idea is already in the minds of the reader. And you have to remind people that this is fictional. So Big Brother, Ingsoc, Oceania, these are all just figments of George Orwell's imagination. Of course, it was based on the Stalinist Soviet Union. But nonetheless, these concepts hold no credibility with the reader. So they're able to actually see the abuses of a system like this. Whereas when you contrast that with the real world, what are the institutions of power today? It's the mainstream media, it's the government, it's the universities, it's the corporations. These institutions have credibility among ordinary people. When the media says something, people actually take that as coming from a place of authority. Now, I know that the media has lost a lot of its credibility over the past couple of years, but I mean, just look at some boomers. Just look at how much faith boomers put in the TV. So some older folks who I know, they'll often say something like, oh, can you believe that people get their news from the internet, that they use social media to get their news, that they're listening to what people say on Twitter? That's unbelievable. Well, the assumption that's going on there is that the source that they're getting their news from, that being the mainstream media, that being the TV stations, the assumption there is that that source cannot possibly be wrong, that that's a voice of authority. People will always the vast majority of people, at least, they'll always default to the source which in their mind has credibility and clout, even if what they're actually telling them is internally contradictory, because the image of authority has so much power over the individual, has so much power over most people's mind, that it will supersede their ability to actually think critically about something like this. So that's why you can get people in the world today who will love dystopian fiction, but then there'll be fans of 1984, and they'll talk about they'll know all these phrases about wrong think and memory hole and everything like that. But then many of them will cheer on as the British government arrests working class white folks for posting something on social media critical of immigration. That's why that happens. It's because this kind of literature doesn't delegitimize the real institutions which actually have clout in the real world.
It's interesting you should say that, because something that I've thought about for a long time, well, you know, like the last year or so, is that when Tucker Carlson was on Fox News and he would say something which was kind of a bit edgy, and everybody would get really excited about it, and everybody was, "Oh, this is great! We're breaking into the mainstream." And since then, he's moved to Twitter, and you'll find him on YouTube or his own website or whatever. And I don't actually listen to him anymore, but there's things which are like much more controversial. He did it just last week. It was just last week where it was all this. I didn't watch it, but because I can imagine what was said. But it was this. Oh, it's all this sort of World War II revisionism.
It was a good interview. I'll say that.
I don't doubt that for a second. I don't. I'm sure it was really interesting. But there's something in the medium itself, though, where if that was on. That same interview was to take place on television, it would have a legitimacy to it, which it doesn't on Twitter. And a lot of people won't like that, but I do think it's true. Even though we laugh at the mainstream and it's cringe and everything, in theory, there's no difference. In theory, the exact same interview could take place. It's the same information, the same points are being made. But somehow, if it's on Fox News in a studio, it does actually have more legitimacy than it does in the same way that If you watch a video on BitChute, it doesn't seem this is the same as watching a video on YouTube, like lower down that ranking level. Or a post, for that matter, a post on Gab is not the same as a post on Telegram, even though everything else is the same. It's the same video or it's the same text or whatever it happens to be. But there is like a hierarchy of legitimacy, I think. And it's kind of depressing to think about, but I do think it's something that people should think about more. And so even when I see Tucker Carlson do controversial red-pilling kind of the masses on Twitter, I do think, like, if that was in a studio and on Fox News, I probably would have watched it. But there's something, maybe it's just me, maybe it's just a personal preference thing, but I think there is, I think you do lose legitimacy when you're not no longer on a mainstream platform.
Oh, 100%. Because think about all of the issues which people in our sphere of politics and the internet talk about regularly. If we're correct about a lot of this stuff, let's say race realism, let's say you could point to things about various aspects of the Second World War. We can talk about aspects of identity, of how liberal democracy doesn't really work, how group identity always supersedes individualism, about gender, about the fact that that men and women even exist. I mean, that one is the most obvious. But, you know, if we are in fact right about all these things, why haven't we won already? Because it's not like we that these ideas have just started with us on YouTube and in the past 10 years or so. These ideas have existed for years and years, decades and decades. In the case of something like race realism, the concept of race has existed since antiquity, since ancient Egypt, and then the actual science of anthropology and dealing with this has existed since the 18th, 19th centuries. If we're correct about all these things, well then, like, why haven't we already won? Why isn't that just patently obvious? I mean, it's patently obvious that it's playing out in the real world. It's easily observable. But the problem is that the mainstream, which has all the clout and credibility, they are totally opposed to these ideas having any kind of influence whatsoever. So when something actually does, you know, go mainstream, the reason that that's actually so significant. So, like, for example, what was said in the Tucker Carlson interview, that's not stuff. I mean, most of that is stuff I've already heard before, but it is significant in that even someone like Elon Musk actually shared it. I think that he probably got a call from the ADL afterwards, and I think he actually deleted the post. But that actually grants like an extra layer of legitimacy to the ideas which we are discussing. Another thing I pointed out was that, not that I want to go on about this interview too much, was that someone like Daryl Cooper, the guy who we interviewed, didn't come across as far right, but as kind of just this 90s era centrist who's a lot more mainstream acceptable. And the fact that he's embracing some of these ideas and actually discussing them on a fairly big platform, that is significant because that shows like them gaining credibility. But getting back to the story of 1984, you can't make the mistake of thinking that that because a regime is so obviously oppressive, because they have things like thought police, because they have things like the memory hole, because they're rewriting history. Like in my essay, I actually went down a list of things just in relation with the past month in Britain alone that you could draw parallels to 1984 with. And I kind of found myself even cringing a little as I wrote this, because I just felt that was patently obvious and just something which had been said time and time again. So the point I wanted to make with that is not the fact that present-day Britain reflects 1984 in some regards, but the fact that it's so glaringly obvious, but it doesn't matter. And the reason is because, you know, 1984 is a story which is written to basically to show you this illegitimate, corrupt, unjust regime, whereas people actually do put legitimacy in the mainstream institutions when they act the exact same way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I forgot to bring up earlier, which I meant to bring up, is the way they are shrinking the language in 1984. So they're trying to they even say there's nothing more beautiful than the destruction of words. And there's a certain word, but I forgot what it is now, which it's a kind of word which they want to get rid of because it's expressive and poetic. You know, if you say, I'm trying to think of an example of what it would be where you can substitute it for just a hard technocratic term. And we see this destruction of words going on in our world as well. We see that where people's vocabulary and their ability to write and everything is being shrunk. I don't think that's a state policy, actually. I think that's got a lot to do with technology. I'll blame the system for a lot. Well, I mean, some people would say they actively are dumbing down the population. There's probably an element of that. But I do think, I mean, we both write on Substack, and I bend over backwards to use more archaic language and to be inventive with how I use stuff. And I read other Substacks and I think, I would use that there. It's one of the reasons why it's good to read old books, because you realize there's a flow to language. I mean, there's even just to Orwell's 1984, but there's this flow to language. It's better. It's just better. And it makes me sad. For example, a few weeks ago, I dug out, I've got a nice hardback copy of Edgar Allan Poe. And I was reading some of his short stories, and the flow of language is just absolutely beautiful. And of course, this is exactly what they're trying to root out in something like 1984. Because they don't want you to think in ways which can express depth and feeling. Even what I'm looking at on the screen here, Ingsoc, that's actually, it was once English socialism, I think. And so they've kind of just whittled it down to its most moronic, idiotic, kind of thought-terminating way. And it's terrible to see all of these words. I've picked up words now which have entered my lexicon, which I really wish weren't there. Like I preferred it when we talked about cultural Marxism and not woke. And people say it's different. I don't see that. I just see it as being more advanced. But it's correct that woke does sound more gentle and clownish than what it actually is. And doesn't it make you wonder how that happened? Well, why did it become woke? Why did we stop calling it cultural Marxism? And now everyone just calls it woke, which is, you know, like that hard edge got taken off it. I never understood that. But this is here we are. So it gives it that extra kind of postmodern clown show feel to it all when we're actually talking about something which is utterly ruthless and disgusting.
Yeah, and the other thing is that you also see this play out in the verbiage which is used by the mainstream media and the establishment. For example, there's that phrase which has become which has come into common use in the UK: small boats. So, I mean, the idea is now that men from the third world arriving on Britain's shores, fighting age men. Well, it's just small boats arriving now. It's small boats. What came before that was they called them refugees. But refugee, now these days, that just means any non-white person who decides to show up in the West uninvited.
They're even changing that now. So it began, if you go back to Tony Blair's era, they called them illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants, illegal immigration. That's what they used to call it. And you will see that word illegal pop up from time to time. But then, yes, along with small boats, they've changed it. So it became refugees. So there's a difference between an illegal immigrant, which is implied that they just broke the law, they came to your country without any paperwork, and they're a problem. Illegal implies problem, you know, criminal. And then they change it to refugee. And refugee is basically somebody fleeing a war. You know,
it's a poor, downtrodden person who you have sympathy for.
It's somebody you have sympathy for. But now they're changing it again. And the new one that Starmer's bringing in is irregular immigration. So all of that, and which means, which is kind of coded in such a way where the assumption is they are just immigrants. It's just that the paperwork's not yet in order, but we will sort that out too. And you can see that they're just watering down this and what it's doing. And this is game. This is worked out. This is game theoried and workshopped in NGOs and in think tanks and all of this. And it's exactly what they're doing with it's INGSOC. So that when you get into the nudge departments in this manipulation of how people think, precisely because they aren't these kind of empirical, classic liberal rationalists, you know, they're not Bertrand de Juvenal or no, who am I? Bertrand Russell, I mean, that they're not Bertrand Russell to give this kind of hard, realist look at it. People do go off emotion a lot, and they're exploiting that to manipulate the language so that they don't know whether they're coming or going. So in a few years' time, you'll find that the words like illegal immigrant or refugee will be memory holed, and what we'll have instead will just be irregular migrants who it's as if they're setting the bar higher and higher to actually get them out of the country. All of this is like, it is Orwellian. You're right. It's a cliche, like what you say before. It's a cliche. And we know that this kind of destruction of words and inventing new ones to manipulate people. And yet, despite the fact that 1984 exists, it happens right in front of our eyes every day. It's really mind-bending.
Like the example, which I just put as like the nail in the coffin for why dystopian fiction is not going to wake people up to real world dystopia. You mentioned this earlier, but one thing which I came across a couple years ago was that they've now rewritten 1984, like a feminist retelling of 1984 from the perspective of Julia. So I just want you to digest what this actually is. This is 1984, a famous story about dystopian totalitarianism, about the dangers of doctrinarism, and they've now released a reimagined version that's designed to bring this story about the dangers of doctrinarianism into line with the doctrines of the current zeitgeist. And you know what's the worst thing about this? George Orwell's estate signed off on this idea. They approved it. So even the people who have been entrusted with the legacy of George Orwell, the granddaddy of dystopian fiction himself, even they're true believers in our world's version of INGSOC. And that basically is just like, for me, that just proves the point right there that people are not going to be these rational individuals who are able to critically think about the institutions and the systems which govern them. They run off this emotion, and when it's coming from this position of authority, you better believe that most of them are not going to wake up when something like sounds like it's out of 1984 happens. Don't expect them to wake up. I mean, another example from recently that's really reminiscent of the novel is, if you remember that a couple of months ago, everyone was saying, the entire media was saying, well, no, there's nothing wrong with Joe Biden's mental state. He's perfect. Oh, he's younger than ever. And this was the party line. The entire Democratic Party, the entire mainstream media, and their entire support base was just, oh, Joe Biden, he's just good to go. And then after that embarrassing debate with Trump, a day later, the entire thing just shifted. And now now the entire party line from the Democratic Party and mainstream media was that Joe Biden is senile and he can't go on. And within an instant, every single one of that party's supporters immediately shifted. And the idea that a day earlier they had believed the exact opposite didn't even register at all.
Well, and I mean, what happened to the fella who shot Trump? Like, why did he do it? What was the motivation? Well, what happened with the security services? How did they get that close? What was the failures there? Is there going to be some kind of investigation, or is that just now gone? Is that, we're just moving on, or is there some kind of thing going on with that? Because you go back, you know, if you go back and you, let's say you scroll back through somebody's Substack or YouTube channel, and you look at all these stories that have happened, and you think, What happened to that? What happened to that story that popped up and everyone was talking about it for a couple of days? It seemed like a big thing, and it's like now it's just what?
Remember at the beginning of the year when there was supposed to be a U.S. civil war because of Texas's border dispute with the Biden administration?
Yeah. What happened to that? What went on?
I don't know. I have no idea. It just dropped out of the news cycle, and then it was, well, pretty much gone. I mean, the other thing... Yeah.
No, go on.
Well, the other aspect, my other criticism of 1984 and... I guess also not even just the novel itself, but also its impact on the culture. First of all, I think that it's too cartoonish. I don't think that any kind of regime, no matter how repressive, is going to have the slogan, war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Nobody like outright, out and out admits that they're evil. So even someone like Joseph Stalin was still trying to convince people through the propaganda that this was the workers' paradise. Nobody, he wasn't out there saying that you're a slave and you should be happy about that. So, I mean, I think that's too cartoonish. But more fundamentally, though, I feel like the dystopian fiction genre is still stuck in 1984 in the novel and 1948 as in when the novel was written. It seems like we're incapable of imagining a dystopian or tyrannical regime which doesn't reflect regimes from the 1930s, be it the Stalinist Soviet Union or National Socialist Germany. It feels like, at least a lot of the dystopian fiction from the mainstream, it always has to be referential to one of these historical regimes where there was this larger than life leader, all this political iconography everywhere. They gave these fiery speeches. There were these jackbooted secret police officers just beating people down with clubs. And it helps if the leader has a mustache too. It feels like our image of totalitarianism, it hasn't gotten beyond that. It hasn't actually evolved in any way because I find that first of all, it's outdated. Because I don't feel like regimes of the 20th century will reflect the aesthetics of the previous century. But also, it kind of gives us this idea that something can only really be dystopian if it has this great leader, if it has this political iconography everywhere, if it involves fiery speeches or something like that. And you see, like why I'm really kind of cynical about, I've kind of gotten a lot really cynical about 1984's impact on the culture and why I kind of just groan every time I hear it brought up. You'll see all these memes, and I'm sure everyone knows what I'm talking about. You see them coming from both the right and the left. You'll see like some image of, it could be Trump, it could be Biden, it could be any political leader. They'll be giving a speech in front of and there'll be a flag beside them, and they'll have like an emotional look on their face as they're delivering a phrase. And then someone's going to put image of either Hitler or Stalin beside it and saying, "Oh my God, look, it's the same thing. It's literally 1984. I mean, that's become a meme itself, the literally 1984. It really kind of, I find that this, obsession with the 1930s has really kind of it has trivialized the entire concept of totalitarianism, and really it's obfuscated the actual essence of it for just these aesthetic trivializations. So like, I mean, I got into this in my other essay about how in many ways dystopian fiction has facilitated the creation of an actual dystopia. I mean, I don't know if I need to get into that one too much because it's not entirely related to 1984. But this image in people's mind that it's just something aesthetic now. So you'll even get, you know, there's that stupid Handmaid's Tale TV series about like this dystopian future United States where it's ruled by this Christian fundamentalist regime, which forces women to wear red robes and white hoods and forcibly impregnates them in concentration camps. You know, it's a feminist's paranoid delusion. But a hilarious example I came across of this was that Huffington Post wrote an article about how this was back in 2018. This was Christmas 2018 when Donald Trump was still the president. They wrote this article about Melania Trump's video in the White House where there were a bunch of red Christmas trees. and the image of these red cones looks really similar to these red robes that women were forced to wear in this in The Handmaid's Tale. So it's literally like this. It's literally The Handmaid's Tale. And I find that just like the entire concept of totalitarianism has just been dumbed down to such a degree that it's almost meaningless in our culture today and in actually understanding the actual system which we live under.
Yeah, I mean, just on the sort of the terminology, I will say though that objectively, the term diversity is our strength is, it's Orwellian, but it's also just complete nonsense. And what I mean is, even it, like leaving aside what they're actually saying there, if you just take it apart, like diversity is our strength. Since when, if you look at the word diversity, it means to divide, divisive. And that's all, first of all, throughout history, that was a standard technique to divide and conquer. It was like, it's like this old thing. But just, can you name a single of example from anywhere in life, the world, where something has been strengthened by dividing it? Is there any example of that? Does it happen on buildings? Does it anywhere? unless it's kind of like, let's say, I was going to use the example of maybe like an oil rig, where if it's got lots of stands, it may be stronger. Or I can't think of this idea where you divide something and break it apart and it becomes stronger. It's just obvious nonsense that they're saying. It's not true. But great. There's an unusual amount of super chats come in for these streams. Most of the time I'll get like a fiver or something, but there's a few come in, so I'm gonna hit them now. Unless you've got any parting shots, I'm sure it will come up in the super chats as well.
Then. Well, I guess the one other thing I wanted to say was that I find, you know, you even see this with a lot of boomer conservative types, is that when some talking points that they'll bring up, they'll say that, so, well, George Soros, well, he was a Nazi. He was alive in the Nazi time, which, of course, is incorrect. I mean, we all know his ethnic background and the policies which he has supported throughout his life. Or you'll see them say like, well, Klaus Schwab, he was part of the Hitler Youth, which again, I don't think is even true. I don't think is actually factually correct. But what you see is that with these talking points, you hear this with boomers a lot, they have to have this kind of referential point of totalitarianism from the 1930s. They have to draw it back to that. And I guess just the fact that something like 1984 has become the granddaddy of the genre, but I think more so that the genre just hasn't moved on from it. I find that it makes it like almost impossible for people to actually look at the system which actually exists today and understand it in any kind of context that's not related to the great boogeyman of the modern world. And it just makes actual like structural critiques of the actual system we have today almost impossible, because the people can't actually see it for being tyrannical in and of itself. They have to refer it back to something else. And I find that that really kind of just serves to uphold the system a lot more than it actually does critique it.
I mean, part of the problem is that if there's a couple of sort of shows that I've caught with of like, the Black Mirror has done sort of dystopian images of which are more current, you know. There was another one. I've watched the Black Mirror one where she's like on a social credit system. And there's another one called Severance, which has been suggested to me, where when people go for a job, when they go to their jobs, they can kind of take a tablet or something and they become another person. So they've got there's a person for their job and then there's another person in the private life. So it raises, and they don't know, they're not aware of each other. So the person sitting at home of an evening doesn't actually know where their body has been during the day. And it's a way to kind of dampen out the drudgery of office work. And there's another one And the opposite of that would be that the person who actually does the office work has never known, like, not working. So that's pretty dystopian and weird and clever. But you'll notice that they're sidestepping issues which are actually current in terms of authoritarianism and what people worry about. And so the problem that you have is that any kind of honest appraisal of totalitarianism in the West and authoritarianism and thought police and all of that, it would actually be a critique of the people who are in power. And the reality is that they don't want you to do that. So what you get is like really weak stuff, or you get the system itself pulling a Goldstein and kind of presenting this sort of, well, the one that you were talking about with the women and the Handmaid's
Tale.
And then you've got like V for Vendetta.
Yes.
So what you have is like even the Hunger Games to a certain degree. I'd say that was better. That was a bit better. But the problem they have is that they don't want themselves to be critiqued from the right, because they are in power and their values are completely dominant. And so, like, they, if you want to do a one that really hit home, like the kind of things that the left did in the, say, the 60s or the 70s, as, you know, criticisms, or if you imagine something like American Beauty in the 99 or something, where it's this kind of broadside against suburban conservative American life or whatnot. Well, you notice that they don't actually allow it to come from the other direction. And so what you get is this kind of the Goldstein sort of false manual of the V for Vendetta, which copies all of the aesthetics from 1984, but then just shoehorns in a bunch of sort of politically correct shite. Which nobody takes seriously. Nobody can actually sort of, everybody knows it's facile and superficial and stupid.
Yeah, the second part of my Substack essay was mostly focused on V for Vendetta. Now, I don't want to make the stream about V for Vendetta. I know even you wrote something about it back a few years ago, but the point I wanted to make is that a film for V for Vendetta, which is basically like this total, it's like 1984, but all of the values are Christian, white supremacist, conservatism. That's the totalitarianism. And then the resistance is woke, basically. It's woke, egalitarian, multiculturalist, universalism. The point I made, though, is that something like that, which because the other thing which inspired me to write it was that, I saw you getting in on the action on Twitter with this as well, is that there were people when the crackdown in the UK was happening saying V for Vendetta tried to warn us about this, about an authoritarian government. And it's laughable because that's not the message of a movie like V for Vendetta. The message is not that authoritarianism, censorship, political violence are wrong. The message is that anyone who ever questions the woke, multicultural, whatever you want to call it, universalist egalitarianism, anyone who ever questions that is irredeemably evil, and that that's going to result in this dystopian future, and that person needs to be censored and shut down by any means necessary. That's the real message of a movie like V for Vendetta. So in many ways, I mean, the title of the second part of my essay was how fighting fake dystopias created a real one. Something like V for Vendetta, even though it has all the aesthetics of totalitarianism, of authoritarianism, and one party state and everything like that, in many ways, it actually facilitates the authoritarianism and the overall state of terror that everyone in the West is feeling today over political correctness, whatever you want to call it. A film like that actually facilitates it. So it doesn't actually, it's not a critique of authoritarianism. It's saying that, it's basically saying that, you know, any amount of violence, censorship, and political repression of people on the right is totally justified.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say to the fellow in the chat there, I believe it was the Quran that he keeps safe from it being.
Yeah, the gay man who is persecuted by this Christian fundamentalist regime is so infatuated with the Quran that he decides to keep it under threat of death. Because as we all know, you know, Islam and Sharia law really love gay people, especially ones who share the ethnic background as Stephen Fry.
Yeah. So right, let's go on the way. This is longer than what we usually go for. It's good. It's been a great one. This I knew it would be. I knew that there's plenty gold to mine in this subject. Like, we've got a little audience and it's nice and cozy. We hit the numbers today. So Hunky Haggis sent in his beer on the coffee app. For 1984, do you think, as it becomes more obvious that Christianity is oppressed and not the oppressor, both in the West and abroad, that the left will start to defend it as they tend to support the underdog, and that those will see a resurgence of Christianity? The answer to that is no. I don't think there's any, under any circumstances, will the left be in any way friendly or supportive of Christianity. I think they'd prefer to just stamp it completely out of existence. I think somebody like Distributist would say they don't need it because they're already engaged in their own heresy of Christianity. But it speaks to everything about it is the opposite of what the left wants. It's not just about the underdog. It's about it being, it's about the left being rooted in materialism and the self. Everything about organized religion more generally, I know they do strategic partnerships, to use technocratic language there. See the way it slips into your lexicon without you knowing it? But back from strategic partnerships powering ahead with the power of AI and all that. I just don't see anything like that happening, like whatsoever, yeah, with the left. We'll never show any kind of sympathy for Christianity.
Oh, yeah, but and
behind closed doors, they just despise all kind of metaphysics and spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, my take on that is they're not going to gain some kind of sympathy for Christianity because it's being repressed, because they're the ones doing the repressing of it. So there's no chance that they will ever have any kind of sympathy for Christianity. I mean, I think that just with something like Islam, it's just kind of that it's just convenient at a time because Muslims can be made into this victim group who is useful to their coalition. But no, there's no chance that Christianity is going to ever be made part of a victim group.
Lateral Twitter sends, I think that's Norwegian krona, 200 Norwegian krona. I don't know how much that is. I think that's nice. They do have a very powerful currency, don't they? But I think that's good. I think that's nice. Thank you very much, Lateral Twitler. So yes, he says, have a nice Sunday, guys. I'll pay for the talk in advance. Thank you very much. Dawn Browning for 5 Australian. Doop, 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 1984. I think that's a kind of reference to some of the Eurythmics. I don't know what, I mean, I'm sure Dawn Browning is way, way too young of a lady to remember. I'm old. I remember the Eurythmics. I remember Sweet Dreams Are Made of These and all that. I'm sure Dawn Browning's way too young to remember those songs. Roddy Murray Films for 10 Europe. Books and films are distinct tools. Films manipulate through visuals, e.g. E.T.'s well-lit alien versus white authority figures hidden in shadow, and books give deeper reflection and character study over time. Yeah, that's true. I mean, to be fair, E.T. does, Spielberg does, he's very clever and manipulative in what he does with E.T. because it's as if the adults are kind of something separate from the children. So, yeah, if you watch E.T., you'll notice that the adults' heads are kind of, I think you see the school teachers, but by and large, the adults and the mothers, but by and large, it's kind of like they are a different species and not E.T. And when you think about Spielberg's possible motives for this kind of thing, it's extremely sinister. X-ray Space 3033 for $10. Just says cheers. Well, cheers to you as well. Sensum Communum, £20. I think he's from up the northeast, same as me, you know. Sensum Communum, I'm sure of it. There, thank you very much. He says, been a long while since I managed to catch a classic movie stream live. I've just got in now, so we'll rewatch later. But thanks to both of you. In a culture of idiocracy, common sense is a precious commodity. Thank you very much. Arklo Rocks for 20 euros says, all right, lads, just wanted to express a bit of appreciation for the monthly streams. A very welcome bit of insanity. Thank you very much. And then Lateral Twitter for another 100 Norwegian kroner. And he has a tip for a good service. Hey, oh, we've got another one here. We've got, is that? Oh, Phil Regular for 10. Hey, they're flying in. I've never seen anything like this on classical movies. Did you mention the scene where the Vietnamese girl gets killed in the river? Oh, that's the, it's the Rambo reference. I'm not doing that one again. You'll have to go back to the Rambo stream for that one. That comes up a lot these days. How's the garden looking? Just harvested my peas. It's looking good. I've got a few. I've been absolutely hammered by the slugs. I've got a few cabbages in. I'm looking to get them out, wind things down, get a load of mulch in with some fertilizer, and then I'm going to be overwintering with some onions and garlic, and just trying to get some nutrients back into the soil for next year. Really, that's me current state. And I've just got a load of winter hardy onions that I've got the seedlings for, and that's it. That's the winding down. And I'm going to be busy on my own compost over the winter months. So, wow, I mean, I've never known a classic movies be as popular and have as many super chats as this one. We've hit the big time here. We've hit the big time here. Well, I think of all those streams that we've done, plugging away on obscure westerns and all of that. But
finally, it paid off.
Right, what a great! I love me classic movies. I love that there's a regular chat, and I like doing these. It's a little bit off the beaten track, and it gets me away. I mean, because there's been unrest in England, I feel like I kind of got really into that for the last month, and I'm justifiably so. You know, I think it says a lot about the Labour Party and just the state of the country. And I'm getting myself back on track. I've got a couple of essays which I'm almost finished. I did a video the other day. I'll probably do another video soon as well. I'm on fire at the moment, any parting shots, Endeavour?
No, I think we covered it.
All right. So thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I'll catch you later.